animals. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and on today's show, I'll bring you the second portion of the interview I recently conducted with Temple Grandin on stage at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. Those who heard last week's show will recall that I aired the first part of this interview then, noting that Grandin can be described with various labels, among them, expert on animal behavior, prolific author, longtime professor of animal science at Colorado State University, fervent advocate for autistic people, and tireless lecturer. In lieu of presenting another of those lectures, Dr. Grandin sat down with me at the Paramount Theater, talking in front of an audience of upwards of 1,200 people. We covered a wide range of topics in the portion that we heard last week, though that discussion did feature a preponderance of autism talk, which made sense given Grandin's expertise, personal experience, and the audience assembled to hear this conversation. Again, this interview wasn't designed Talking Animals, but I do feel it was worth sharing on the show. And today's installment is a good deal more animal-oriented than last week's, and also more varied, as we additionally present the audience question and answer segment, which inherently was characterized by a mishmash of subjects. We hear part two of that discussion with Temple Grandin in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. First, a couple of programming notes. We have a fantastic lineup of programming this Friday, March 8th, in celebration of International Women's Day. All terrific women programmers all day long this Friday, March 8th. Cannot wait. Great, great lineup, great shows. Be sure to tune in all day long if you can. Also, on the next two Wednesdays, March 13th and 20th, I'll be away tied to a family trip commuting with the so-called Friendly Whales of San Ignacio Lagoon in Baja, California. This involves the mother gray whales who have migrated to the lagoon to have their babies, and then counterintuitively, given how fiercely protected most animal moms are of their babies, the mother whales bring their calves up to humans in small boats to meet and often pet the baby whales. It's pretty magical. I'm delighted to report that Bev Capshaw will be hosting those shows in my absence, and her shows, including on Valentine's Day, are some of my favorite recent editions of Talking Animals. Next Wednesday, March 13th, Bev will feature an interview with Dr. Adam Duncan Harris in advance of his lecture March 16th at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Pete, plus a brief talk to the Humane Society of Manatee County about their Paws in Motion Walkathon Festival on the Bradenton Riverwalk coming up on March 16th. So that's all coming up next week, March 13th in my absence, and then she'll be again here March 20th with another great show. I'll return to the program March 27th. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Courtney Scott, elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, the animal protection organization that's been operating now for some 40 years. She'll fill us in on the disturbing development of the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, Florida, now featuring a live elephant named Lady Essex performing tricks and apparently offering elephant rides. Courtney will give us the lowdown and recommend steps we can take to urge festival organizers to halt all elephant appearances, ideally well before the festival is slated to end on March 31st. More details on this situation when Courtney Scott joins us a bit later on the show. Right now, though, let's hear the second portion of my recent conversation with Temple Grandin. Picking up the conversation at this point, having just made reference to screen time and video games, and I'm following up on that issue. So, recorded February 12th at the Paramount Theater in Austin, here's the second half of my conversation with Temple Grandin on Talking Animals on WMNF. So, you've made a reference to people being on video gaming and screen time. It seems like you've got a growing concern about just...
Well, the problem is these kids aren't becoming video game designers. Also, AI is going to take over all the low-level animation jobs. Like, okay, making the hair on an animal look real. You look at the credits now on those animated movies. There's like 100 people on there do what's called a low-level animation. Those jobs will all go away. Where the things that's not going to go away are the total hands-on things. So that same kid who's into video games, there's been some very good successes with introducing the auto mechanics. And they found out that motors are more interesting than video games. So one of them is fixing trains for the railroad, and they just love them, absolutely love them. That's how you get the video gamers off the video games, but is how? Introduce mechanics.
How is someone leaving a video game behind to pursue auto mechanics?
Because what you graduate, somebody had to introduce it. You gradually wean them off.
Okay.
And you have to find the right mechanic. They'll be patient, and you might start out with just 30 minutes in the shop. You do it gradually, and there's been five or six young adults successfully weaned off. I've talked to about three of them, and they said, well, you know, I just gave up video games because motors were so much more interesting.
Wow.
And we need
great
mechanics.
For sure.
I've been on some very questionable elevators lately. One of them's...
was there a bold issue of some kind?
Well, they're not being serviced. The elevators aren't getting serviced. I went in a fancy Hyatt hotel in another state, and they had a six-month extension on their inspection certificate. That a real fancy Hyatt. Yes, I did notice that.
Wow. That's nerve-wracking, too. Well, now we've got flying issues and elevator issues and...
Elevators are mechanical devices, and that fixing them is not going to get replaced by artificial intelligence or ChatGPT.
Yeah. Thank goodness. So what, on a, I guess, tangential note, what is your view of social media?
I don't do social media.
Well, there is a Temple Grandin, and I think Facebook
page and Twitter. Professionally
feed
managed.
Oh, okay. You don't have anything to do with it? Okay. We must not be against it, I guess.
No.
Yeah.
But I one of the problems of social media, and I predicted this when Facebook was invented, I gave a talk to the Kansas Cattle Association at Kansas State University, and I said, social media magnifies the voices of radicals on both sides of many issues. I predicted that when it was first invented.
All right, I might switch gears for a little bit. I've got to periodically, since I've been talking to you on the radio, and especially since I've been talking to you...
Well, you're probably posting your shows on it. You're not getting involved in all the chit-chat stuff.
No, I'm switching gears to a different topic altogether
okay
now. Yeah. Yeah. Because over the years, whenever I'm gearing up to talk to you, I try to talk to friends that I know that have kids that are on the spectrum or actually older kids now. So that's giving me some specific questions or issues to raise with you. So one of those friends has a doctor who just started college in an art and design school, and that prompted some contemplation by my friend that I found pretty intriguing. I wanted to get your reaction. So she wrote me saying, I'm faced with quandaries about accessibility in higher education and the workplace. What are these young adults on the spectrum owed as far as accommodations? And should they even be owed anything?
There are some accommodations you're going to need. But let's get specific about accommodations. And one of the most common ones is a little extra time on tests. Having a quiet place to study. Another thing is, if the teacher just goes yak, 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 you know, for some task involves a sequence. I can't remember the task. I need a checklist. Same format a pilot has. There's a lot of jobs that would be saved with checklists. Because jobs have been lost because they... boss would go yak, 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 and then they did the wrong stuff because I don't have much working memory. I have to write down in a step-by-step format any task that involves a sequence. And that's a very simple accommodation that would save a ton of jobs. So I don't just like to talk accommodations and generalities, but I've been doing these talks long enough that I've actually figured out which accommodations are the most important. Checklists and getting rid of LED lights that flicker. And you know how you can find them? Whip out this thing and film the room in slow motion video. So the people that are not bothered that can see it on the slow motion video, it will show up. And I tell architects all the time, single most important thing we can do, and this works for head injuries too, and some dyslexics, is please don't put LED lights in the lecture hall that about 5 to 10% of the students are going to see them flicker. And it makes concentrating on the lecture extremely difficult.
All right, so now that's a really good point. And I think she had some other questions, but I think they were about accommodations that were less specific and more about...
Well, what's happened, I've done so many of these talks, that there's certain accommodations like the checklists.
Yeah.
Okay, if I have to, like, take a machine apart, clean it, assemble it, give me a checklist, take apart steps, cleaning steps, reassembly steps. Pilot's checklist format in three sections, just so that's be like pre-taxi, pre-takeoff, then you pass 10,000 feet and go out of tower control.
So assuming the bolts are in place.
Just,
yeah.
But you put it in sections, that take apart steps, cleaning steps, reassembly steps. There's like three parts to the checklist. It's exactly the way aviation does it.
And that kind of that also sort of reflects the kind of thinker that you are, right?
Well, you see, I have no working memory. So how did I memorize how a whole meatpacking plant works? Well, it took me about 6 months of Tuesday afternoons in the 70s to videotape it into my head. That didn't happen instantly. You know, then there's a point, like when I first went in this great big plant, I go, this place is so complicated, how does the plant manager understand it all? I found out 20 years later that he did not understand it all. But after going in there a whole bunch of times and sort of videotaping into my mind little pieces of it, I gradually just put it all together. And I can turn the camera on in my head and walk through the plant.
Wow.
But I didn't do that instantly. It took time to download those videos, like maybe, you know, month and a half of 2 months of Tuesday afternoons.
I was just out of curiosity, why was it Tuesday afternoon?
Because that was just the day I figured out to go over there.
You know? Okay.
Yeah, that's the only reason.
All right, I got you. So I think we should maybe, so we don't run out of time, because we're getting sort of near the end of our time of our conversation part, and then we'll still have the Q&A. But I want to talk a little bit more about animals.
We haven't talked about, I got a whole bunch of notes here on animals.
Well, it's hard to have a conversation with Temple Grandin without spending a good portion talking about animals, I think. So a question that came in for one of those that we solicited for people that wanted to raise a question says, I'm teaching a precious smart 4-year-old boy with autism how to ride horses. He loves it. He's learning how to use his muscles and body to sit up straight and stop his horse and make his horse go. He listens to me and understands my directions. I'm amazed by his progress. Here's my question. In your opinion, what would help him most with his vocabulary? I talked to him the whole time we were out riding. He will repeat one word out of a sentence I've said. His mom would like his vocabulary to grow. I'm wondering if I sing songs with him, will he begin to put more words together? Do you have any advice?
Sometimes some kids can learn to sing before they learn to talk. Singing is on a different part of the brain. Also, I've had a number of parents say that their child did their first words on a horse. Because they have to balance and his rhythm at the same time. Plus, horses are really fun. So that's three things. But, you know, it's getting the kid out and doing things. Now, I've just got to talk about animals. Animals don't think in words. Animals are sensory-based thinker. It's memories and experience, seeing, touch, smells. Okay, I read about the dogs that you read about in the orange orchard that they can detect that horrible citrus greening disease.
Oh, yeah.
That is, you wrote a story about that.
Yeah.
That's totally smell, and they can detect citrus greening disease before the lab tests can detect it.
No, it's made a huge difference to an industry that's been decimated by that citrus
greening. Oh, it's terrible. They have to rip the trees out and burn them. And then try to do it before it spreads.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
So did you want to interview me for a while?
Did what?
Did you want to interview me for a while?
When I grew up.
I'm just kidding. I just did, because you were talking about the story that I wrote for the
Well, I Googled you.
Hey, I'm not going on stage with this guy.
I looked up your stories.
Without checking him out first, yeah.
No, I looked him up. And there was another thing about greyhound racing. Yeah, I looked him up and I read them.
Okay, well, that's very nice. Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like I passed.
And I thought that citrus greening story was very interesting. And
well, thank you, Dr. Grant.
I really liked that article.
All right, so here we are. So you got what else is on your yellow sheet?
Well, I want to talk about animal memory. And that animal memory is very specific. And let's take, for example, cattle get accustomed to a cowboy on a horse. That looks very different than maybe a person walking on the ground. So their flight zone to the horse might be only 10 feet because that's very safe and familiar, where the person on the ground is novel and new, and their flight zone might be the width of this stage, might be four times further. You see, because the memory in this case is a picture. And my student, Megan Corgan, did a very interesting study with a children's play set. Colorful play sets about this big, slide and a swing for toddler, bright plastic colors. And they walked fillies and colts by it 15 times until they no longer stopped, no longer reared up their heads or flared their nostrils. And when that play set was rotated 90 degrees, it became a new object. Think about it. The slide this way looks different than the slide this way. It became a new object. You see, we would look at it and go, yeah, that's a kid's toy. The horse doesn't even know that it's a kid's toy, but it visually looked very different. And this might explain why sometimes a horse spooks for no reason. I was up at our equine center and someone had put a Western saddle up on its horn. And then when you look at the underside of the saddle, that looks totally different. That might be something, and I'm seeing it now as I'm talking about them. They'd spook at that. And then I repeated the experiment with a green chair with people walking by it on their horses. We did this at a walk. All the stuff was done in the walk. And then when the chair was rotated, half the horses did a hard stop. This was all done in a walk. I didn't want anybody getting dumped because these horses would have slammed on the brakes otherwise.
So those horses got spooked, but then is there anything to establish why the other half of the horses basically didn't get spooked?
Well, they have differences. Some horses get scared more easily.
Okay.
So half of them stop.
So it's just temperament differences or personality.
There are temperament differences in horses.
Yeah.
And some get more scared. And another common problem you can have with cattle and horses, both people go, oh, my steer was fine at home, my show steer, and he went berserk at the show. But you've got a lot of new things to see at the show, like flags, bikes, and balloons. So one of the best ways to get your animal used to this stuff would be to decorate the fence with flags and let your horse or your steer go up to it. Let them approach the novel object, because novelty is interesting when the animal can approach it. And it's scary if you just take it and shove it in their face. So you want to get the horses and cattle used to a whole bunch of stuff, so that when they see flags and balloons at the show, they're not going to be afraid of them.
And isn't that in some ways kind of the fundamental concept of the designs that you've created, where the cattle don't get spooked in it going in a certain way, whereas in the previous designs or conventional cattle machinery, they would get spooked by some of those
things.
Well,
one of the things you have to do is just take the distractions out of it, because there'll be some little reflection on wet floor, or you might have a shadow that changes with the time of day. So at 10 o'clock in the morning, everything's working fine. And then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a giant shadow appears that looks like a spider monster that's cast by the overhead structure. Cattle won't walk over it. And then 30 minutes later, that shadow disappears. And I remember a startup just a couple of years ago on a big new plant. Everything was working fine. And I go out, and then I look at this shadow, and it like a wagon wheel spoked shadow on a real bright, sunny day, and the cattle wouldn't walk over it. And half an hour later, it was gone, and everything was fine as the sun moved.
Right. So no shadow. Do you still ride horses?
I don't. I'm worried about falling off. I'm 76 years old now. I don't want to fall off.
That's too bad. You probably miss it, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But one thing I have been doing is I've been helping out with their horse training class. It's called the Right Horse Program. And they take rescue horses and rehab them.
Oh, wow.
And some of these horses have been abused in the past. And one common kind of abuse is being abused with a jointed snaffle bit. And so think about that jointed snaffle bit's a different feeling picture than just a one-piece straight bit. And one of the horses was just frothing at the mouth to the jointed snaffle bit. And we tried a one-piece solid bit, calmed right down. It was like opening a new file folder that in his brain that was not associated with bad.
Just basically starting.
Oh, he just calmed right down. We got rid of that bit. Because the fear memory, you know, think about it. I had the students hold different types of bits in their hand and shut their eyes and think about them as different feeling pictures. And a jointed bit, which the horse in the past had been abused with, was a different feeling picture than a one-piece bit.
Didn't bother them.
Oh, it worked like magic. I couldn't almost believe it. It worked so well.
No, that's great. It's great, again, to see that horses can be rehabilitated and
well, sometimes in Animals and Translation, one of my books, I wrote about a horse terrified of black cowboy hats because that was associated with abuse. White cowboy hats, tan cowboy hats, just fine. But black cowboy hats, they were bad because the horse was looking right at a black cowboy hat when this idiot threw alcohol in its eyes. Really bad.
That's awful.
And that's totally awful. Now, I can change a bit, but I can't eliminate all the black hats in the world.
Right.
And I can work to desensitize it, but the problem is those fear memories are sort of like a post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's going to be really hard to totally get rid of that. You go to a horse show, you're going to have black cowboy hats there. I can't do anything about it.
No, that's so awful. But it must be gratifying to see, on the other hand, the way these other horses recover and adapt, and there's kind of like a redemption story there.
But if you can remove the scary thing, I can control what bit goes in a horse's mouth. So that's something where I got rid of the scary thing. And then I have the students hold the two types of bits, and think about, just close their eyes and think about the, what they feel like.
Yeah.
Because it's a touch memory.
Oh, that's great. Do you have anything else on your sheet?
I'm gonna go well, back. Those were some of the main things.
Something on my sheet.
I also had some things on here about animal breeding. One of my things I'm very concerned about is over-selecting an animal for an appearance trait, a production trait, or a performance trait, and then they start to have problems, like bulldogs that can't breathe.
Yeah.
You're making them so flat-faced. I've got problems with that. We're getting some problems now with beef cattle, where you're breeding so much for big muscles that we're getting some leg conformation problems,
yeah,
getting some congestive heart failure problems because we're over-selecting. You know, we got to start looking at what is optimal, not maximum.
Chickens being bred to be...
Well, the chickens actually, the chickens have actually fixed some of the problems.
Yeah.
They've bred a big leg on them. I do have to disclose, I'm a consultant for the Costco rotisserie bird. They paying enough to put two students through school, so I'm just closing.
All right. I appreciate that. Sad but true. Okay.
But that's what they found. They pushed this chicken. Okay, what's been found is to push the metabolism and everything that hard, you have to do your management just perfect. Because if you start out with bad hatching eggs and bad chicks, they're going to have problems, like downers and be lame dads. You're going to have problems with them. You got to do everything just right. The other thing that's been learned with some of this high-performance chicken is if you back off maybe 2% on the breast meat, you back off. Or maybe you send them to slaughter 1 or 2 days earlier, then it's okay. It's a system that's basically on the edge. But you've got to do everything right, and you have to start with really good hatching eggs. That's very, very important. Well, they have hens that breed them. And so you've got to have a good breeder colony. They can't be sick.
All right. So I think we're very close, maybe another couple minutes before we're going to get into our Q&A part. So I have another question or two for you. But if you have another question or two on your sheet, let's go with... I'd always go with Dr. Grandin's questions first.
Well, another thing I'm really interested in is grazing management. We have huge parts of the land in Colorado where... In eastern Colorado, the only thing you can do with that land is graze it. You can't grow corn on it. They tried last summer. That's how tall the corn got. I'm not kidding. It got that tall.
Wow.
At harvest time. Stupid little corn. Yeah, that's what it was.
What were the cobs? How big were the cobs?
Well, you don't have water in the ground. You don't have water from the sky. The only thing you can do with that, 100 miles of eastern Colorado, is graze it. We have 20% of the land in the world. You can only graze it. You can't grow crops on it. That's not enough water. And grazing animals, I think, are part of a sustainable agricultural future. Now, you got to manage them right, and you got to rotate the pastures right. And another thing that we can do with grazing animals is graze cover crops. Okay, so you might raise corn, soy, and then a cover crop that you graze. We also can use grazing animals to help with fire mitigation. There's, juniper bushes grow all of everything. It's going to be fire getting. But there's a lot of people saying that, the livestock, all the livestock are just terrible. We should get rid of them. If you actually used right, they can be a very important part of sustainable ag. And I've written a paper about that. And that's another thing I'm really interested in. But I have to emphasize, you have to manage it right. If you manage it wrong, you can wreck the pasture. You have to do it right. So that's all that's on my yellow paper.
All right.
Okay. All right.
Well, I'm glad you brought that sheet today.
I do have the grazing paper up on my phone, so when we're over at the book table, I can bring it up on the phone and you can see it.
All right, so I have one or two more questions, then we're going to take some Q&A from the folks here in the theater. So this was actually submitted to us in advance from someone I think that's probably attending tonight. But it says, has it been a struggle for you as an autistic person to deal with popularity and attention of the world? And if so, what has helped you manage and regulate all this so you don't get burnt out as easily?
I figure it's a responsibility. It is responsibility. And I take it very seriously.
I didn't know if you were going to add anything to that. All right, so my final question is sort of related, or at least final for now, is, as we've talked about, you fly constantly, you give lectures constantly, you're doing things like this, conversation. you're a professor. I mean, super busy world and always on the go. So if you had a day where you had none of those obligations, you were home, you had no interviews to do, no particular things, how would you spend that day? How would Temple Grandin spend an ideal day off?
Well, I like to look up interesting things online, like Castle Bolts, for example. That was something that I did. Yeah. I even found out I can buy them.
Somehow I knew we were coming back to the bolts. Yeah.
And during COVID, I worked on my visual thinking book and did a lot of research on the different kinds of thinkers. That's something I like to do. Sometimes I just like to go to a movie. I remember going to the two Avatar movies. Those had to be seen in a theater. That's stuff I sometimes like to do. I also saw Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Okay, there you go.
Okay.
That's great. We're learning some important things that we might never have learned about Temple Grandin. That's good.
Okay, but that's stuff I like to do. At home I have graduate students that I like to... want to help them get their projects going and have them get into good careers. That's something I feel very strongly about.
That's great. Yeah. So in a way, you're serving as mentors, kind of like in a variation of what Mr. Carlock did for you.
Well, and I have some students I've had some students where they just did their studies, and I have other students where I helped them with some of their personal stuff, and obviously I can't go into that. But, I mean, I did a lot of, help them, they had some rough times in their lives, and I just helped them figure things out.
And when you say personal stuff, that actually reminded me of something else I was maybe not going to ask you about. So this is my very final question, I promise, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the folks here at the theater. So are you familiar with the show Love on the Spectrum?
Yes, I am, yeah.
And do you think it's... What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I saw that show, the Good Doctor, and he didn't seem like he learned very quickly. this is where an autistic person, the way I learn social things, like the thing back criticizing the welding, I'm a bottom-up thinker. So if I've got good mentors helping explain to me how I should act in different situations, then I get a big database to work off of. But actually, I get the most satisfaction out of friends who shared interests. I was on a plane one time. We had the greatest time. I was with a lady construction manager. And we spent 2.5 hours discussing concrete forming systems.
Wow.
That was a wonderful flight.
That's great. That's perfect. All right, well, maybe we should leave it there. Thank you very much, Dr. Grandin. And we will get a couple of microphones set up if they're not already. And we'll take some questions from the audience.
That's Temple Grandin in a conversation we had recently at the Paramount Theater in Austin. We're going to hear the final installment, which involves the audience question and answer segment, naturally covering an array of topics. So to set the scene a bit, the house lights have just come up. It's otherwise been dark during the actual conversation that we had. The microphones are being placed so audience members can line up and ask Dr. Grandin some questions. So let's return now to that conversation. This is Temple Grandin on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Oh, good. We can see you. That's good. Hi. Can't see the audience otherwise. Okay. We've just been talking into a black hole all night.
Hi, Temple Grandin. I just wanted to ask you about how in the world you decide what to do tomorrow. Because you've built such an amazing foundation. Like, to me, you're one of my, heroes for a bunch of reasons. But, sorry.
And I've got a schedule for the next 6 months, so.
but you do have a schedule every day for the next 6 months. But every day in the morning, like when you get up, what's the first thing that... get you out of bed and make sure.
Well, it gets me out of bed. This is really great breakfast reading. I like to relax with a lovely, beautiful issue of either Nature or Science and read the latest research. I like this. I save those magazines where I can savor them for really long breakfasts.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Temple Grandin.
Thank you. Over here.
Hi, Dr. Grandin. I had you for facilities design management in 1994.
Oh, when I first came, I came to CSU in 1990. So you were in one of my early classes.
Yes, and I cherish that class so much. I absolutely can concur with what you say about sense memory, because if I'm watching a video or someone's on TV or even in my own home, if that smoke detector battery goes off, my dog has a catastrophic meltdown. I got him at a year old, so I don't know what his history is, but he's got some negative history associated with the smoke detector sound.
Well, and it's a very piercing, sharp sound designed to wake you up. It's not pleasant to listen to.
Right, but even the faintest little bit. But about your class, so everyone here in Austin who's been north, who's come south out of Leander on 183 and Anderson up there by McNeil, your class regarding how animals move through chutes with cars, that explains, because people in cars are just cattle, and that explains that it... I just wonder if you have ever worked with highway designers.
Oh, I can tell you that the Interstate 25 south of I-70, all the exits are laid out wrong. They're absolutely horrible. I hate them. And I take the bypass to avoid it when there's a lot of traffic, because I like it when the traffic's real bad, just get in the right lane and go slow. But the problem is it forces you off.
Yeah.
And they are laid out wrong, and they're just awful. And you go to another city, they're not laid out wrong. No, it's very similar. And some of them are laid out really nicely, and some of them, they're not laid out right. And those are definitely not laid out right.
So have you worked on any translation?
I haven't worked on it, but I certainly wouldn't design the exits so that if you stay in the right lane, it's going to force you off unless you keep moving over. It's absolutely terrible.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you. By the way, I don't think we were able to get a microphone up to the balcony, but if anybody up there wants to just come down for a question while our remaining time... Well, you can come to the mic, sir, is what I guess I was suggesting. Sorry. Yeah.
We can't hear you.
No, I'm just inviting people that are up there to come down and ask a question or two in our remaining time. Okay, it's your turn over there.
Hi. This is probably a little bit of a selfish question, but I have an off-the-track thoroughbred who, he's come a long way since I've had him, but his reaction to the squeeze chute noise, opening and closing of it, I guess is so similar to the starting gate noise.
It's the same kind of sound.
Yeah. Is there a way to reframe that for him, or do you have any advice?
Well, it's triggering a fear memory is what's happening. Because when the head gate on the squeeze chute would sound just like a starting gate.
Yeah.
It's enough similarity. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can try to do is you just gradually, kind of habituate him. Reward them for not flinching.
Okay.
Might try some clicker training. In my book, Animals Make Us Human, I've got a section in there on horses, and that's worked very well with Mustangs because they associate the click with positive. Okay. And Sarah Matlock, during COVID, got about 15 Mustangs from the BLM and managed to, with clicker training, to get 10 of them ready for a halter class with strange men showing them. And I actually went to that show.
Right.
And they associate the click. See, the advantage of the click is that it's a variable reinforcement schedule, so they don't get a treat every time. Okay, if you make a little bitty noise with a squeeze chute, mm-hmm. and he doesn't flinch, then you give him a click, he's going to get a feed reward for not flinching. And you start out just not slamming the squeeze chute around, just start like this one ratchet. Well, you got a manual squeeze chute?
Yes.
Okay, well, then one ratchet.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just very gradually habituate him to it.
All right, awesome. Thank you.
No, I'm sure he thinks it's a starting gate.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Over here.
Hi, Dr. Grandin. I just wanted to tell you how much of an inspiration you are to me. I was diagnosed with autism when I was 5 years old, and at 2 years old, I took my first steps because I couldn't walk or anything, and we used animals as part of my therapy.
Good.
And now I'm studying to be a veterinary technician.
Wonderful.
And I work with raptors, and sometimes I think about how sensitive they are to sound, especially owls, and that's what I struggle with sometimes.
So you can relate to that animal that's sensitive to sound. Sometimes with sound, it can help, like kids afraid of a vacuum cleaner. You have the child turn it on and off, where they control. They control, or let's say you don't like electric drill sound. You go in the shop and you just do it a whole bunch of times where you're controlling the noisy thing, and that could help you with that sound sensitivity, is having that control. Because another thing that I've learned is if you wear headphones all the time, it'll make the sound sensitivity worse. You can have them with you all the time. Try not to wear them except for the really terrible stuff. Okay, industrial strength bathrooms with all those automatic things going on, yeah, that's a place you put it on. But then when you get out of there, then take them off, but have them with you. You see, that's control. You have them with you. You know, this whole thing, a control can really help. But what I would do with the horses, just grab, you know, make just one little metal sound, the squeeze chute. And if he doesn't flinch, then gets a treat. Gradually try to condition it. But you get a really bad fear memory, they can be almost impossible to totally get rid of.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Sir?
Yes, doctor, I have a question for a six-year-old that is a visual learner as well, but is also a gestalt learner. Do you have any recommendations?
He's 6 years old. Is he fully verbal?
Yeah. Well, he's very verbal, but he's not fully verbal.
Well, lots of hands-on things. Get him doing chores in the house. You know, little kids like to imitate what the grown-ups do. Get him out doing things. And when it comes to devices, you know, mother-limited TV to 1 hour a day, 2 hours on the weekend. I would never suggest banning devices. Forbidden fruit, that's a bad thing. But I think we need to be really limiting them, because if a kid's playing on devices 6 to 7 hours a day, they're not doing anything else. That's why I did my kids' books, Calling All Minds and the Outdoor Scientist. Lots of things to get them outside doing things, because that's what I did. I would spend hours tinkering with a little parachute to get it to open more quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about maybe 5 more minutes of Q&A here, so go ahead, please.
Okay. Hi, I'm Dr. Zilmer. I'm a public health veterinarian for the USDA. So I just wanted to say thank you, because I think without you, I probably wouldn't have a job based on all the humane handling pathways you've given us. My question is, the hardest part about my job right now is I work at many small plants, slaughterhouses, and having to communicate with the plant managers and plant owners that assume they know more than I do about animal handling because they've been doing it longer than I have. I've gone as far as trying to do what you do and get in the chute on the level of the animal and show the owner these are the changes that you need to make, but some of them refuse to listen. So I just want to know your approach on talking to these, I would say 99% of them are gentlemen. But maybe
well, the one thing is, one thing we found, it put a non-slip floor in the stun box. And that's going to stop this little slipping they do like this. And, you know, back in 1999, I worked for Burger King, McDonald's, and Wendy's to inspect plants using the AMI or NAMI scoring system. And at that time, I had a 5-year period, I had the power of McDonald's, and I made them fix the floor. Now, I was very careful to do reverse conflict of interest. I had big, expensive things up to sell. I bent over backwards not to do that. You know, like a non-slip floor in the box in some older plant made a big difference. Getting electric prods out of your hand and not constantly, not screaming at animals. Non-slip flooring, changing the lighting a little bit. Not having a head holder giving the animal a view of the slaughter floor. Mm-hmm. You know, put a screen up. Just very, very simple things like that can often make places work. And there were 74 plants on the McDonald's approved supplier list. Only 3 had to buy expensive stuff. Everybody else we fixed with a lot of repairs. Stunning, busted stunners, that was a major, major thing. And those, I've written it all up. I've got 5 journal articles starting in 1998 up through 2005 in Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, Applied Animal Behavior Science. But some of this stuff, you change the lighting, and then they go in easily. You put a non-slip floor in there. And now there's all kinds of mats you can buy, which were not available back in 1999, that you can put in the box. And the animal won't jump around. You know, these are simple things to fix.
Right, right. That makes sense. Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much and everything that you
Well, then I do have a book you might want to order online. It's called The Slaughter of Farm Animals, Practical Ways of Enhancing Animal Welfare. It's a textbook.
I'm going to buy it and give it to
Amazon's
me.
Got it. The Slaughter of Animals, Practical Ways of Enhancing Animal Welfare, and it's got sheep on the cover.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. So here's the bad news. We only have time really for probably one more question at each mic, but here's the good news. There's a book signing right after this, right, Dr. Grannon?
That's
right.
You'll
be out signing books, so if anybody gets lucky to get their book signed, they could probably ask you a question.
I'll sign every one of them.
You could probably ask a question or two while you're signing their book, right? So we still have more chances.
No, I can answer some questions. Happy to do that.
Okay, so let's do one more each on each side of the mic. Go ahead, please.
Want to get the little girl.
It's your turn, and then the young girl for sure. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Grannon. It's an honor to be here. We're kind of stuck in a rut. I have a 7-year-old son who's on the autism spectrum who's very intelligent but struggles with his speech. And we're at this bridge where he needs to be challenged and beyond like the baby ABCs, 1, 2, 3s. But it's hard to get that bridge from one spot to the other.
Is he improving? The only thing.
Yes.
If he's improving, then you're doing something right.
Okay.
And is he making steady improvement?
He is.
All right, then you're doing something right. As long as you're getting steady improvement.
Okay.
Then you're doing something right.
Okay, that sounds good. I mean, we have him in a gen ed classroom. He's around his peers. We push him, but I just want to make sure we've got that.
But if he's making improvement, you see, now you can sometimes, make the mistake of shoving a kid into sensory overload, And then you might as well pound on a brick wall. That's not going to work. And it tortures a kid. But if what you're doing and you're making nice, steady improvement, mm-hmm. where he's gradually improving, then you're doing something right.
Okay. Slow and steady.
Just slow and steady.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, for our final question.
I want to make sure
young
we get
lady.
This
Hi.
Little girl.
Go ahead.
Hi, Ms. Grandin. My name is Amelia. I'm 11 years old, and I had a question about autism.
Okay.
How do I tell my friends about autism without them getting, weirded out?
Well, why don't you tell them Einstein was autistic? He didn't speak until age 3.
Cool.
He had a pretty good career. Yeah.
But, some kids at school, they think that autism is weird and stuff like that. They don't like it.
You see, the thing is, the way they kind of look at it is half of all the people would be more social emotional. And, when I listen to country and western songs driving to the airport, it's all about romance and love and emotional stuff. And then there's a few truck driving songs. Those are the ones I really like. And then the other half of the population is more into what they do. It's less emotional. I was geeking out on the 100-year-old concrete ceiling. I could see the plank forming they used to build the concrete work at the theater in the dressing room. I was kind of geeking out on that. Looking at I could see the antique rebar they didn't put in the center of the forms there. That's something that you do. So sort of half the population leans more they really get into their work. The other half, the emotions make their world go round. But then right in the middle, when is this slightly being geeky become autism? It's pretty arbitrary. You see, in the mildest forms, it's just a personality variant. But then you're going all the way to someone who never learns to speak and has problems controlling movement. But some of the nonverbal autistics who learn to type independently. And so you've got this huge spectrum. It's all called autism. But in the more milder types, which you probably are, it's just a personality variant. And you might get more interested in your horse or whatever your favorite thing is. Where I had a terrible time as a teenager because the stuff that girls were interested in, teenage, I was not the least bit interested in. Then when I started finding all the construction stuff, I thought that was just wonderful. It takes different kinds of personalities to make the world go round. And the real social ones, who's going to fix the power plants when they froze? It's going to be the autistic person that's going to fix them and maybe prevent them from freezing. Let's look at it that way. I think we'll end it on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's thank you again, Dr. Temple Grandin. Great conversation. I enjoyed speaking with you once again. And just out in the lobby is the book signing. We're immediately out in the lobby of the theater, so you can ask a few questions if we ran out of time or if you'd just like to get your book signed.
We'll see you at the book table.
Yeah. So thank you again. I'm Duncan Strauss. The show's name is Talking Animals, if you want to check it out. Thanks so much for coming, and we appreciate it. Thanks to everybody at the Paramount Theater as well. That was my interview again with Temple Grandin on February 12th at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. My thanks to her and the folks at the Paramount. This is Talking Animals on WNF. In a moment, I'll talk with Courtney Scott, elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, about the elephant performances and rides apparently being offered at the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, Florida. Anyone who's listened to this show for any length of time or is concerned with animal welfare knows that performing elephants have a dismal life, typically involving cruelty and the use of the bullhook to train and control the animal, and often harsh travel and living conditions. Commonly in scenarios like the Renaissance Festival, the elephant lives by herself, and elephants are famously social, preferring to live in large herds. So we'd like to persuade the festival organizers to hold all the elephant appearances if we could, ideally well before the festival is slated in on March 31st. More on that in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, let's step into the Comedy Corner with Beth Stilling and a piece called Beth's Pets on Talking Animals on WNF.
Wherever I live and whatever city I'm in, I will always have pests. Like in Chicago, I had rats. Just one rat. Like, I got home and my roommate, I live with two guys, and they're like, yeah, Beth, there's totally a rat in the kitchen squirreling around in Tim's cereal. And I was like, okay, I'm going to leave. Came back 3 weeks later, and I knew the rat was still there because somebody had been trying on my sweaters. You know what I mean? The toilet seat was up. We were getting care packages from Shredder. So that's... He was still there. No return address on those. When I lived in L.A., my first place had tons of roaches. And I found out that we had them because I was eating some Koshigo lean. And I thought a little prize had dropped out. But it was actually just a tiny movie script that one of the roaches was working on. Koshigo lean does not give prizes. It gives you explosive gas and diarrhea. The Potter Balls are sponsored by Gary Indiana. I'm sponsored by Koshigo Lean.
That was Beth Stilling in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Beth's Pest, taken from her album Sweet Beth. Now it's time to talk with Courtney Scott, elephant consultant with In Defense of Animals, about this distressing elephant situation at the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, Florida. I'd like to welcome Courtney Scott here to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Courtney.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals.
Absolutely.
So just so we have some context here, maybe you could briefly describe In Defense of Animals, like just an elevator pitch, maybe addressing its chief mission and so on.
Well, it's an international animal rights organization, and it works on many different animal issues to help rescue where that's possible, to also free those from captivity where that's possible, and to raise awareness about all the brutality that's done to animals routinely throughout the world.
All right, that sounds like a pretty good overview from what I know. You guys have been at it, as I mentioned earlier in the show, for some 40 years, so I've been doing great work for many, many decades now. So as for the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City, I confess I don't typically pay close attention to what goes on over there. It's not really my kind of event. Plus, I live in a different part of the state. I imagine you're professionally attuned to any new developments involving elephants. So how did you hear about this situation?
Yeah, well, actually, we were contacted by a supporter of ours because we have supporters around the country who contact us about different things going on in their area. Mm-hmm. So this came up, and she let us know, and I did some research into it, and we put out an alert about it, or, you know, a post, and let people know, especially people in that area, what was going on with this Renaissance Festival and the abuse of the elephant.
And is this the first, as far as anybody knows, the first time the festival has offered elephant rides and performances?
In that area?
Yeah.
Or do you mean in general? Oh.
Well, this particular festival, at least, yeah.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know that. I can get back to you. It is something that goes on around different venues.
Yeah.
Not just there. But as far as the Dade, it's Dade County, I believe. Let's see.
Yeah, Dade City.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would imagine it's something that goes on a regular basis, perhaps annually. But I don't know how many times it's been at this particular festival.
Yeah. Fill us in a little bit. What does this elephant do? And can you just give us some details about what's going on over there with the elephant?
Well, you know, basically it's similar to a circus act. So you can imagine that. The minus the tutus, I guess. But the elephants are made to stand on these platforms, raise one leg, carry on their back riders.
Just clarify, excuse me for interrupting those, because it sounds like you're saying elephants plural. For some reason, I thought there was just one elephant.
Well, in this case, this elephant is by this one owner.
Okay.
So, yeah, in this case, it's just this one elephant.
That's one too many, I think, as we know.
There's other elephants that go on at different festivals, but Lady Essex is the elephant.
Yeah.
And Lauren...
Murray.
Lauren Murray is the...
Murray, yeah.
The owner of this elephant. So this is just an example of how these elephants are used in these festivals. And the elephant is an entertainment product, you know, the same as they would in a circus. And I think that we did a good job of pointing out how the skeleton of an elephant is not designed for riding. Their skeleton on their back actually protrudes. So you're putting weight on the protruding part of their skeleton.
Yeah.
So it's not a good thing. And over time, they get all kinds of back issues and problems from the carrying that weight.
Yeah. Well, that's more scientific and I guess physiological than some people get on this. But I mean, just generally, for those listening who may not be steeped in the travails of a performing and traveling elephant, maybe you can talk about just some of the other challenges an elephant typically faces beyond just what you've talked about, kind of the skeletal impact of being ridden that way.
Oh, yeah. Well, traveling is, of course, another issue. They're trucked around. And also, clearly, she's training the elephant with a bullhook. So that just shows you this probably started with this elephant was very young.
Mm-hmm.
And they typically do that so they can break their spirit. And then they basically are trained to know that once they point that bullhook at them, that they have to comply.
Or else.
And
yeah.
So then, their life is just, there is nothing similar to a real elephant's life. Let's put it that way.
So,
and they live. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, Courtney. I'm just going to say, so we don't run out of time. I guess my main question at this point in our remaining time here, we'll have a few seconds, is what can we do about it? How best can we complain to the organizers or see if there's any way to halt the elephant activity over there?
Yeah, I would say that's a good choice to talk to the organizer and tell them you don't support it.
Okay.
You know, and of course, don't go to it.
Right.
You don't want to enable any more of this type of behavior or cruelty, which is what it is.
Right. All right, so people just look for ways to contact the Bay Area Renaissance Festival in Dade City about the elephant. Again, it's Lady Essex is the elephant, and the woman riding and slash training is Lauren Murray. So, okay, Courtney, well, thank you very much.
If you want, I just noticed that the phone number is right here. I can give it to you. The Bay
okay,
Area.
Quickly, because we're almost out of time.
Sure.
I'm so sorry.
I'll give you the local number, 352-999-5946.
Okay, and that's how we can contact the festival organizer.
Yeah, and I also have the email.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for that. I'm so sorry, but thank you so much for
your help. Okay, well, thank you, Duncan.
Thank you very much. Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for Slice of Life coming up momentarily.